Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the legacy of the Florida Cracker Cowman.
These days, if you're a cracker, you wear that as a matter of pride and with great honor. It's not the term that it used to be.
We'll discuss retirement homes in Pinellas County.
Located away from the traffic of urban life, they included swimming pools, large recreation centers, fishing, and shuffleboard courts.
And we'll talk about the Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
His beard may be stubble like a cut over sugar cane field. His clothes may be dirty, but the look in his eyes lets you know he won't yield. He's from a breed that has died, but he has survived, and the world he once knew is gone. He's an old cracker cowman, existing a long way from home.
What does it mean when someone is called a Florida cracker? Many believe that the term refers to pioneer cowmen cracking their whips. Others think that the name Florida cracker comes from the practice of cracking corn to create dietary staples of early settlers.
Jimmy cracked corn and I don't care. Jimmy cracked corn and I don't care. Jimmy cracked corn and I don't care. My master's gone away.
It's also possible that William Shakespeare created the word cracker in his play King John from the 1590s.
What cracker is this? The same that deafs our ears with his abundance of superfluous breath.
Whatever its origin, the term Florida cracker is used both positively and negatively. In its broadest sense, Florida cracker is the name for pioneer settlers and their descendants. These pioneers were mostly of Scotch-Irish heritage and first arrived in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Dana St. Clair is author of the book Cracker, The Cracker Culture in Florida History.
We know that the word itself is very old. It's 16th century Old English. Craker had an extra E in there, but it was a term that the British Crown and the Spanish Crown used to describe these rogue white settlers in Florida and the Southeast. And we actually have historical documents that describe these people as Crakers. The word goes way back, though. Even Will Shakespeare used it. And if I can remember it, I think it was King John the play where he said, "What Craker is this that deafs our ears with this abundance of superfluous breath," which is a nice way, of course, of saying somebody was full of hot air.
The term cracker, when students, teachers, parents hear it, more than half, you can see their eyes light up and their eyebrows will raise, because unfortunately it has become a derogatory term in the past.
Kara Hoblick is executive director of the Florida Agricultural Museum in Palm Coast.
But that's part of the education here, is that we explain the process of how the cracker term came about. And the pride. Florida crackers are very proud that they are Florida crackers, and it is a way of life, a heritage that has gone through many years and developed over time.
The earliest documented usage of the word cracker refers to a braggart, a boaster, and a lover of tall tales of Scotch-Irish descent. The term evolved to include unauthorized white settlers who came to Florida before it was named a United States territory in 1821. Dana St. Clair.
By the time the Spanish and the British were settling Florida, it became known as a word to describe these rogue white settlers who paid no attention to the authority of the crown. They would tell them where to live and they wouldn't live there, and they would tell them they couldn't live in a place and they would. And we have letters going back and forth to the Spanish and the British crown describing that.
The independent spirit of the Crackers came from their Scotch-Irish roots. Escaping war, poverty, and religious oppression in the 1700s, they emigrated to the Carolinas and Georgia, with some making their way down into Florida. From inside the Clark Homestead at the Florida Agricultural Museum, Kara Hoblick says that the life of a Florida cracker was challenging.
Daily life, just like in this house, 1880, everything the family did, and it was the mom, the dad, and the children, from the minute they woke up until the minute they went to bed, they worked. They worked here on the farm. And anything they ate or wore or used, they produced themselves. The only way that they would raise money was through sugarcane grinding and selling sugarcane syrup. So if they needed something that they could not make, like bricks or something, they would store up the syrup, take it to town, and that was a big day to go to town and either trade or sell their syrup.
They had the ability to settle and subsist in very, very challenging areas throughout the Southeast. And we know that the interior highlands were farmed. There were cracker fisher folk on the coast, and you know, down in the Keys, we call them the Conks. That was what a Key West cracker is. They figured out how to subsist very much like the Native Americans did. The Native Americans developed settlement patterns based on the resources that were available to them, generally food. And that includes the estuary resources, shellfish and fish. There were a lot of crackers that survived that way. But in the interior areas, they grew their own food. They made their own products. They built their own houses. They made their own clothes. So they were self-reliant, self-sufficient.
Florida's cracker cowmen, also called cow hunters, made the cattle industry the driving force of Florida's economy well into the 20th century. The state was the biggest supplier of beef to the Confederate Army during the Civil War. Florida's cattle industry can be traced all the way back to Spanish exploration in the 1500s. Sandra Wise is with Crescent J Ranch at Forever, Florida.
Well, it was on Ponce de Leon's second trip to the New World that he brought horses, actually, and cows. People are not sure of how well that went on that second trip, because some of the historical information has the cattle scattering, as the Calusa, I believe, Indians were the ones that met him on that trip. So perhaps the leftovers of those cattle, many of them that ran wild and ended up with the Indians, was the beginning of what we have here now and as the Florida cracker horses. There are also stories that support DeSoto bringing cattle. But getting here, however they did, they're here now, the descendants of them. And we refer to them as cracker cattle. They're actually Spanish from Andalusia.
Cracker cattle, if we can call them that, what became the Andalusian cattle, were introduced by the Spanish. And Florida had a thriving cattle industry long before Texas and the Great West. But the cracker culture sort of shifted in the early 1800s. It was mainly due to the Arms Occupation Act in the early 1800s, which provided any settler with a certain amount of land. So it became prosperous. It became attractive to folks to start raising cattle and getting free land to do that.
A lack of fences on the open Florida range allowed unscrupulous cracker cowmen to overbrand stray cattle that didn't belong to them and claim new calves from other herds. Dana St. Clair.
Thousands and thousands of these cattle escaped over fenceless ranges. And it was very popular for cracker cow hunters at one time to overbrand and collect rogue cattle. And Frederick Remington, when he wrote his article in the late 19th century, was utterly disappointed and wrote this fantastic, wonderful, disparaging piece in Harper's New Monthly magazine. And he was so incensed by what he saw. It wasn't the romanticized Western cowboy culture that he had just experienced. It was something radically different. But because he was so upset with the way that he was treated and what he saw, that he described it in meticulous detail. So it's one of the best ethnographic accounts that we have of the late 19th century cracker, cow hunter, and cowman culture.
In 1949, Florida became the last state to pass a mandatory fence law to keep individual cattle herds contained, effectively ending the practice of rebranding. While cracker cowmen no longer have to round up their cattle on the open range, the name cow hunter is still used. Kara Hoblick.
There were no fences. So the cowboys that would go out into the scrub to collect the cattle were actually called cow hunters, because they would go to hunt their cattle. If they needed to come collect them for branding or to take them to market, and we do have heritage cracker cattle here. And there's associations that are extremely diligent about making sure that breed is pure. They will not add an animal to their registry unless it is documented and certified that it's a true cracker animal.
Sandra Wise of Crescent J Ranch at Forever, Florida.
Some of the history books refer to what we call cracker cattle as like donkeys, in that they're very small, they're bony. Some of the information also says they're not very good for either beef or milk, but they're very hardy. They've got good immune systems, external parasites, internal parasites, and that's true of the horses too, the Florida cracker horses, which are of that Spanish bloodline.
Cracker culture still exists in Florida, but urban sprawl continues to threaten this rural way of life. Dana St. Clair.
The long arm of civilization is reaching into these areas, like southern Ocala, which is now the villages, used to be cracker country all the way down to Brooksville. I grew up there. I remember seeing that every time I took a trip that way. But they're disappearing.
Kara Hoblick.
To teach the Florida cracker heritage is so important because it's a way of life. It's very important to the many generations that have grown up in this area. There are some families here that have been here for five generations, and this is their family's history. This is a story that needs to be told. And that is one thing that the Florida Agriculture Museum, it's our mission to tell the story of Florida agriculture's past, present, and future. And the cracker is the past, it is the present. There are still many people still living the cracker lifestyle, and we need to continue that in the future too.
Dana St. Clair, author of the book Cracker, The Cracker Culture in Florida History.
These days, if you're a cracker, you wear that as a matter of pride and with great honor. It's not the term that it used to be. It happened somewhere around the time Jimmy Carter became president and the Southern culture started to emerge, and people were fascinated with it. But these days, crackers are at least the ones that aren't terribly private. Crackers are quick to tell you about their heritage because it is that. It isn't just a description of a people. It's a description of their culture, and that's really what they embrace.
The population of Florida has been expanding exponentially since the mid-20th century. Cow pastures, farmland, and citrus groves are replaced with housing developments, shopping centers, and highways. Florida's cracker culture is being preserved, though, at places like the Pioneer Settlement for the Creative Arts in West Volusia County, Fort Christmas Historical Park in East Orange County, and at the Florida Agricultural Museum in Palm Coast.
And dirt bikes scream over land that used to be scrub cow trails, and interstate highways have taken the place of old
Mr. Flagler's raise, and condos rise from the land, and space shuttles fly. And the old cracker cowman don't know how it all passed him by.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime on the web at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, subscribe to our journal, the Florida Historical Quarterly, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Florida as a place of retirement has figured prominently in the state's history and economy. Anna Vemer Andrzejewski, the 2023 winner of the Thompson Award for the best article in the Florida Historical Quarterly, placed the origins of the retirement village in 1950s Pinellas County.
More precisely, she identified the origins in 1955 at Orange Lake Village, 15 miles northwest of downtown St. Petersburg and 7 miles from the Gulf. Andrzejewski argues that focusing on the early retirement community contributes to our understanding of what comes to be called the active retirement lifestyle. The role of mid-20th century gerontology research, state activities in attracting retirees to the area, and the importance of the retirement community to the state economy. Furthermore, she demonstrates that builders experimented with housing forms and community features to appeal to a growing population of retired adults. It was not climate alone that attracted retirees to the area, but the creation of novel and distinctive building forms in the mid-1950s that interested northern retirees to relocate to the Sunshine State. Orange Lake Village was conceived and constructed by James Rosati, a New York developer who relocated to Tampa in the 1940s and who was part of a post-war cohort of innovative developers that included the Levitt brothers and Fred Trump. Initially, like the others, he focused on building small, affordable houses that met FHA and VA standards for sale to returning World War II veterans. As the veteran market for housing decreased, he realized that another pool of potential home buyers was emerging, the middle-class retiree, often white-collar managers or blue-collar workers from the auto industry, whose Union One pensions now provided them with the income for retirement home ownership. In short order, he adapted the affordable housing for the first-time buyers to meet the needs of the retiree market.
Connie, in many ways, Florida sold itself to potential buyers, but it also had a reputation from the 1920s for overselling its merits if not engaging in outright fraud. Rosati must have had a strong marketing campaign to convince potential buyers to invest in housing hundreds of miles away.
Rosati built model homes in New York that potential buyers could view. Surrounded by palm trees and tropical flora, the attractive displays proved very convincing. On the other hand, his sale pitch was tempered with the practical advice that cost of living in Florida was no less than what retirees expect elsewhere. You might be living in a tropical paradise, but you paid the same in living expenses. Houses in Orange Lake were small, one or two bedrooms with living room and kitchen dining area. Some included a carport or Florida room. They were influenced not only by post-war building styles, but by the trailer parks that appeared in Florida, first as tourist housing and later as permanent homes. St. Petersburg in the 1950s had 22 trailer parks. The largest such park, Guernsey City, located between Tampa and St. Petersburg, had spaces for 3,000 trailers. If houses were small and efficient, the amenities associated with retirement villages were substantial. Located away from the traffic of urban life, they included swimming pools, large recreation centers, fishing, and shuffleboard courts. The emphasis was on relaxation, recreation, and socialization in a country club setting. As Andrzejewski argues, quote, the kind of buyer Rosati and Florida builders courted was marked not simply by age, but also class and race. While Orange Lake Village did not have a racially restricted covenant, its suburban form was familiar and appealing for a white, middle-class audience who either had lived in suburbs prior to retirement or, with pension benefits, aspired to a middle-class suburban lifestyle. They could partake of the dream of suburban ownership in retirement because of pension benefits, Social Security, and the possibility of low-interest amortized mortgages. Prior to the passage of the Fair Housing Act, such mortgages were only available to white Americans, placing the dream of homeownership in retirement out of reach for Americans of color, end quote. She concludes, quote, looking at these communities helps us see retirement housing and communities in Florida less as the inevitable result of a desire to flee to the Sun Belt than the result of the perpetuation of a desire to separate and segregate that is the essence of middle-class suburban life in 20th century America, an age-defined iteration of the American dream, end quote.
And of course, such retirement communities continue to thrive today. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Florida Frontiers. Jesse Monick, a history student at Flagler College, tells us about the Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine.
The Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine is part of a legacy that goes back centuries to its construction in the late 18th century when Florida was under Imperial Spain. So what other legacies did the Spanish leave behind for Floridians and Americans which impact us to this day? In order to find out, I contacted Jose Gates, a docent at the Spanish Military Hospital and a historical researcher for Spanish in Caribbean history.
One of the things that I usually talk about is the healthcare structure that was implemented from as early as the year 1224. The organism of the medical board was born, and from there it just snowballed all the way into the future, very similar to today's structures, to any medical boards that we're familiar with today, the AMA, the Board of Surgeons, Board of Internal Medicine, Board of Nursing Associations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Gates illustrates that our healthcare system is part of a long evolution, which has been refined and developed for centuries. The modern conceptions of a medical system being born out of medieval Europe and improved for centuries. Once Spain was united, it too would continue to work on its own medical system, as Mr. Gates had just described. When the Spanish came to Florida, they brought their administrative bureaucracy and military, including their hospital system. So, how did the Spanish medical system influence Florida, and even the United States?
Anything that you're familiar with today in terms of the global aspects of healthcare more than likely would have been born out of our system. So we already had this in place where all professionals would have been regulated. The medical board was related to that. We had professional regulated healthcare providers that took care of the whole system of health for all patients, regardless of their location.
With background and context out of the way, it can now be discussed the nature of how the Imperial Spanish medical system interacted with the Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine. The Spanish Military Hospital was built during the Second Spanish Period, a period lasting from 1783 to 1821, a time when St. Augustine was an important settlement for the Spanish in the Americas. The Spanish Military Hospital was therefore more modern of the hospitals. A crucial question to answer in order to understand how efficacious the Spanish Military Hospital was is to ask what effects the hospital had on St. Augustine during the Second Spanish Period.
Specific to St. Augustine, we had an element that was, call it one of the stronger chains of healthcare that was provided. One of the biggest numbers that usually pops up in terms of the output from this hospital has to do with survival rates. In this case, we're talking about close to 65, even almost 70% survival rate in a hospital that was managed by the Spanish, and in this particular case, St. Augustine, as compared to other institutions throughout the Americas in the birth of the country itself, where some of the practices and techniques still yielded about 30 to 32% survival rate. So that was a very stark product that you can compare the output of St. Augustine's healthcare system.
The Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine has a clearly defined track record, making the hospital stand out among its contemporaries. As a bastion of medicine for the surrounding region in Florida, there must have been a strategic reason for its location. Why did the Spanish choose the location they did for the Spanish Military Hospital in St. Augustine, as opposed to somewhere else?
At least for this particular hospital, its reference really had to do with the fact of where the military installation was located.
So the Spanish Military Hospital was primarily utilized to support the Castillo de San Marco and its personnel, a place to provide professional medical care in a relatively close distance from the military installation. The location chosen was not strategic administratively, nor civically. Rather, the ultimate location was chosen for military purposes.
There was nothing additional or relevant in terms of strategy for Florida, although I do have to say that at that very time, we also had other hospitals that were in the location or, you know, the southeast of what's today the United States.
Given that there was a structured network for medical care in the Spanish Americas, St. Augustine's Spanish Military Hospital would play some active role in the system. What sort of connections did the Spanish Military Hospital have to the Spanish Military Hospital system and the Spanish hospital system in general?
Wherever the empire extended, there was going to be coverage in regards to healthcare. As a matter of fact, going back to our medical board in those days, it was known as the Proto Medicato, and that was the entity that I was mentioning that had been initiated as early as the year 1224. One of the main aspects of it is they wanted to make sure that healthcare was even throughout any region of the Spanish Empire that you traveled to.
Though the sun may have set on the Spanish Empire, their legacy lives on in our history and our present-day society. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Jesse Monick, history student at Flagler College.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and this week, Jesse Monick. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.